Welcome. Today we're exploring something fundamental, the erosion of trust, really, in the US dollar over decades. And we're asking, you know, when people start doubting the world's main currency, where does that wealth actually go?
It's a fascinating path we're tracing. Because what we see today isn't entirely new. It connects directly back to anxieties from the mid-20th century.
Absolutely. It's driven by this fear, right? Especially after 2008, with U.S. debt just exploding. I mean, tripling from around $9 trillion in 07 to nearly $30 trillion more recently. Mm-hmm. People worry about currency debasement, dilution.
Exactly. And that fear forces us to look at which economic laws hold true when confidence starts to fray. We're following that thread, essentially, from physical gold reserves right through to today's digital assets. It's all about the search for scarcity when trust in central control wavers.
Okay, so let's start with the history. We have to go back to Bretton Woods, 1944. The system basically pegged the US dollar to gold at $35 an ounce, making the dollar the global anchor.
Which gave the US this incredible power. The exorbitant privilege, as it's called. They could run deficits, fund things overseas, because everyone needed and, crucially, trusted the dollar.
But there was a built-in flaw, wasn't there? The Triffin dilemma.
That's the key. Robert Triffin pointed out this paradox. For the dollar to be the world's currency, the U.S. had to supply loads of them for trade, for investment. But the more dollars they pumped out, especially funding things like the Vietnam War, the Great Society programs, you know, running big deficits, the less believable it became that the U.S. actually had enough gold to back all those dollars at $35 an ounce.
So they had to keep spending to maintain the system.
But that very spending undermined the system's credibility. The catch-22.
And by the 1960s, that tension was really showing. This dollar overhang became a huge issue. Just too many dollars floating around compared to the gold in Fort Knox.
Right, and attempts to fix it, like the London gold pool in 1961, where major central banks pooled gold to defend the $35 price. Well, it backfired.
How so?
Instead of stabilizing things, it just made it easier for countries to drain gold reserves, particularly from the U.S., which put in half the gold for the pool. It actually accelerated the depletion.
And then you had political moves, like France in 65. De Gaulle basically called out the system.
He did, very publicly. Started aggressively trading France's dollar reserves for U.S. gold. Sent ships, literally, to pick it up.
Wow.
Yeah, and that emboldened others. The outflow was massive. U.S. gold stocks basically halved between 1950 and the end of 1969, down to just over $10 billion.
So the writing was on the wall.
Completely. Mason had no choice, really. August 1971, he suspends gold convertibility. Boom. End of Bretton Woods.
And the dollar becomes a pure fiat currency.
Exactly. But the core lesson from Triffin, it never went away. Even without gold backing, if the U.S. runs massive untamed deficits, which, let's be honest, has been a trend, accelerating arguably since the Reagan era,
right.
That same dynamic of eroding confidence puts the dollar's global role at risk. The trigger isn't gold redemption anymore, but the principle of fiscal trust. That remains.
Which brings us closer to today. That simmering issue of deficits and trust sort of exploded with the 2008 global financial crisis. That wasn't just an economic shock. It felt like a psychological one, too. Bank bailouts, governments stepping in everywhere.
And quantitative easing, QE, that was the big one. People hear money printing, which is maybe simplistic, but the core fear was real. Central banks injecting trillions into the system by buying up assets.
So investors started worrying about their money just losing value, being delayed?
Well, precisely. Not just inflation, but a deeper sense of currency debasement, a feeling that the basic rules of risk and value were being warped by central banks. Faith in the management of the system took a huge hit.
And that triggered this flight,
this
search for things that couldn't be easily created or manipulated.
Absolutely. You saw it immediately in traditional hard assets.
Yeah.
Gold, the classic safe haven. Its price shot up, what was it, about 134% from the GFC through 2011.
Yeah, a huge run.
And look at central banks themselves. Since 2008, they've been net buyers of gold year after year for 15 straight years. They're trying to diversify away from the dollar, reduce that dependency. It's a strategic move.
It wasn't just gold, though, was it? People looked for scarcity in other places, too.
Oh, definitely. Among the super wealthy, you saw this surge in demand for things with inherent undeniable limits. Think fine art auction records kept getting smashed.
Okay.
Or limited supply assets like major sports franchises. Our sources mention NBA teams. Their average value jumped almost 400% between 2012 and 2021, way faster than stocks or inflation.
Why? Because you can't just print another Lakers team.
Exactly. Scarcity. If the money system feels unstable, you put wealth into things that are inherently rare and globally recognized.
And it's right in this environment, this climate of deep skepticism about traditional finance. That's when Bitcoin appears.
The timing is everything. It wasn't just a tech experiment.
No, it was a statement. That first block, the Genesis block, January 2009, it had that message embedded, right, about the UK Chancellor considering a second bank bailout.
Directly referencing the crisis. The whole idea was baked in from day one.
Yeah.
Create a financial system based on verifiable math and code, not on trust in governments or banks that seemed, well, fallible.
So let's look at these digital alternatives. Bitcoin, often called digital gold.
And the comparison makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Its main appeal is exactly what people felt fiat money was losing. Predictable scarcity. There's a hard cap, 21 million coins, period, written into the code.
Yeah.
It can't be changed by a politician or a central banker needing to fund something.
That algorithmic certainty is the selling point. No matter how big the U.S. debt gets, you can't just inflate the Bitcoin supply.
Right. And that's why you see serious institutions starting to take notice. Larry Fink at BlackRock calling it digital gold.
Yeah, I saw that. And their analysts suggesting maybe 1% or 2% in a portfolio as a diversifier.
It signals a shift. It's being seen as a potential hedge against the very risks inherent in the traditional system.
Then there's Ethereum, ETH. Different approach.
Different, yes. But also playing on scarcity. Increasingly so. Ethereum's value proposition is more about utility. It's like the foundational layer, the operating system for decentralized finance, for NFTs, for smart contracts. ETH is the gas that makes it all run.
But it didn't originally have that hard cap like Bitcoin, did it?
No. Initially, it didn't. But they've made significant changes. Protocol upgrades. The big one was EIP-1559.
Which burns fees, right? Takes yep. ETH out of circulation with transactions.
Exactly. A portion of the transaction fee is just destroyed, algorithmically removed from the supply forever.
Okay.
And then you combine that with the merge, the shift to proof of stake, that dramatically cut the rate at which new ETH is created by like 90%.
So less new ETH being made and some ETH being destroyed.
It means that when the network is busy and lots of fees are being burned, the total supply of ETH can actually decrease. It can become deflationary.
Which is where that term ultrasound money comes from.
That's the idea some proponents use. Better than just sound money, like Bitcoin, potentially reducing over time. So both BTC and ETH, in different ways, offer this code-based scarcity as an alternative to, you know, the debt-heavy fiat world.
Okay, so individuals and institutions are getting interested. But then comes the government and regulatory response. That feels like the next crucial phase.
It really is. The moment crypto moved from niche to mainstream, regulators and governments had to react. You saw the rapid approval and massive inflows into Bitcoin and Ether ETFs in the U.S. by 2024. BlackRock's Bitcoin ETF hitting $50 billion in assets in its first year, that's not fringe anymore. That's a wall of institutional money saying this is here to stay.
And that forces politicians' hands, doesn't it?
It does. We saw legislative proposals surface, like the Bitcoin Act, suggesting the U.S. should actually hold Bitcoin in reserve. That specific bill didn't pass, but the idea was out there.
But something did happen with reserves, right?
Yes.
An executive order.
Yes. In 2025, an order directing the U.S. Treasury to actually retain seized cryptocurrencies, specifically Bitcoin, as part of a strategic Bitcoin reserve, calling it a unique store of value.
Okay, stop there for a second. The U.S. government is officially holding Bitcoin as a strategic reserve, like gold or foreign currency.
That's what the directive implies. Not just liquidating seized assets anymore, but holding them strategically. It's a subtle but profound acknowledgement of Bitcoin's perceived value and staying power, even from the issuer of the currency it was designed to critique.
That's fascinating. But then there's the other side of regulation trying to control the digital dollar itself, the stable coins, the Genius Act you mentioned earlier.
Like the Genius Act of 2025, or acts like it. This is where it gets really interesting in terms of reinforcing the existing system. Mm-hmm. These regulations aim to make stablecoins safer for users. They mandate things like 100% reserve backing. So for every digital dollar issued, there has to be a real dollar or equivalent held in reserve.
Makes sense. Builds trust.
It does. But look at what those reserves have to be held in. Mostly U.S. treasuries and cash.
Ah, so these private crypto companies issuing billions in stablecoins
are essentially forced to become massive buyers of U.S. government debt to back their digital dollars.
So the innovation in crypto ends up creating captive demand for U.S. treasuries.
Precisely. It's a way to harness the digital finance boom to help fund U.S. deficits. It shores up trust in the digital dollar while simultaneously reinforcing demand for the underlying fiat system's debt. It's quite a strategic loop.
So let's circle back to Robert Triffin. He warned about the paradox back in the gold standard days.
Yes, that the reserve currency issuer has to supply the world with its currency, usually by running deficits, which inevitably creates distrust in that currency's backing.
What would he make of today's situation?
I think he'd see the same fundamental paradox at play. The U.S. is still leveraging its exorbitant privilege, running significant deficits. But the escape valve for concerned capital isn't just queuing up for gold anymore. Now it's diversifying into these non-sovereign, digitally scarce assets like Bitcoin, or potentially deflationary assets like ETH.
So the dilemma has just gone digital.
In essence, yes. And U.S. policy, like with the stablecoin regulations or holding BTC reserves, seems to be adapting, trying to kind of co-opt or channel some of that digital flow back towards supporting the traditional system. It's complex interplay.
So the big picture takeaway here seems to be we're moving towards a world with multiple recognized stores of value, not just the dollar.
It certainly looks that way, a multipolar landscape for storing wealth. And importantly, the underlying driver is the same fear that broke the Bretton Woods system, concerns about sovereign debt and potential currency debasement by inflation. That fear is now driving capital towards assets secured by algorithms, not just central bank promises.
Which leaves us with a final thought, maybe something for you, the listener, to consider.
Yeah, think about this. If the U.S. government itself, through things like the Strategic Reserve Policy, is starting to treat seized crypto as a strategic national asset, Are these digital assets just a hedge against inflation for individuals anymore? Or are they quietly, maybe inevitably, becoming a necessary component for nation-state financial stability too? A hedge for the state, existing outside the state's direct control.
A new kind of reserve asset, sitting alongside gold, perhaps.
It's a provocative question. How sovereign power interacts with non-sovereign digital scarcity. That feels like a defining issue for the coming years.
Something to definitely keep an eye on. Thank you for joining us for this analysis.
Thank you for helping us really deep dive into this incredibly complex chain of compute, cash, and chips today.
My pleasure. It's a fascinating and important area to watch.
And thank you, our listener, for joining us for this deep dive. We hope you found it insightful. We'll talk to you next time.